Since 2005, Blue Hat has been where the security research community and Microsoft come together as peers.
To debate and discuss, share and challenge, celebrate and learn.
On the Blue Hat podcast, join me, Nick Fillingham.
And me, Wendy Zanoni, for conversations with researchers, responders and industry leaders, both inside and outside of Microsoft.
Working to secure the planet's technology and create a safer world for all.
And now, on with the Blue Hat podcast. Welcome to the Blue Hat Podcast. We have Lee Snyder here joining us today, who's going to give us some insight into cybersecurity conference world and what she does at Microsoft, and maybe a little insight onto how to get your talk accepted when you want to speak at a conference. Lee, welcome. Can you introduce yourself?
Sure. Hey, everyone. My name's Lee. I'm a principal security engineer here at Microsoft. I work in our Entra product line, and I help secure any sort of Entra product. I have kind of a unique role on the team compared to other principal security engineers. I really function as more of a security architect, working on kind of whatever the team needs. So I don't really have a specific security domain anymore. I work across all domains.
Architect, if you could explain a little bit what that means for those that are not familiar with what a security architect is.
Yeah, so basically the way I look at it is I'm the person you bring in when you don't have anyone else to solve something. So it can really be very varied. So I could be working one day on, you know, an active incident and helping route the right type of fixes. And the next day I could be working on something like our risk management and trying to understand what our top risks are and how we drive them down. I could be working on where do we have detection gaps. I could be working on, trying to think what else, breach preparedness. It really runs the full gamut of security, and it's really just based on what the team needs at that time.
And so as an architect, do you find yourself mainly in like PowerPoint and Excel? Like, that came across as silly, but I just mean in terms of, is your job about, you know, we think about an architect who's architecting a building, and they're mainly in tools that create sort of visuals that are sort of diagrams and explanations of how things work and fit together and order and process. Is that a lot of what you do?
Yeah, but it's mostly in Word, I'll be honest. I come from a background that's very heavy in writing. And so for me, I know how to write something. And since coming to Microsoft, I've kind of had to learn how to draw things for other people, because that wasn't actually used at my last company very much. It really was about what you wrote down and like how you explained your ideas in written format. And so, you know, doing things like presentations and pictures is new to me. And I'm, you know, happy to expand that skill set. But mostly a lot of it is writing and doing like analysis. So we look at, you know, things like retrospectives to kind of understand what kind of patterns are we seeing and what type of things do we need to go fix. So a lot of it's just reading things and then writing up what we should do, if that helps explain kind of my role better.
It does. How did you get interested? Did you go to school for cybersecurity? Did you have a completely different plan? And how did you end up here?
So I have a BA in economics, and I actually have an MBA as well. I had no idea what I wanted to do when I graduated from college. I just knew I really didn't want to do econ things, but I needed a job. And I went and worked actually in economics research. And so a lot of my original, like very first set of college job was writing large statistical jobs for professors. They'd be like, I need to do this. And I'd be like, okay, I'll look up how you do that in SAS. And I would write these large SAS jobs in Unix so they could, you know, process data, which was a really weird first job, I'll be honest. And then I just did a really traditional IT trajectory. I did frontline support. I did desktop engineering. I did what nowadays we call, you know, SRE or site reliability engineering. It wasn't called that when I did it. And I focused actually at some point along that journey in identity and access management. I'll be honest, I like organization, and identity and access management appealed to that sense of getting things organized. And that's actually where I thought I would spend the rest of my career. And randomly got interested in security because people are like, well, how do you secure your things? And nobody at the time was focused on that. And it was just like, okay, well, I guess I'm going to write the plan for security in addition to the plan for DR, because I probably need that. And it just sort of snowballed for me from there. And I didn't actually move into security until I was out here on the West Coast. I was working for Amazon, and I moved into application security. And this is a running joke with anybody who knows me well, because I'm not a developer. My whole background is infrastructure. I can script, that's not a problem, but I wasn't a developer. And I remember just being like, what do we do in AppSec? When I got my job. And they're explaining it, and I was like, are you sure you want to hire me? But they said yes, and you know, off to the races, I guess. It was an interesting crash course in all things like dev for me. And I was like, okay. It was great. Loved it, but I still think it was a weird mix.
It's a very common, I think Nick and I are realizing that we're asking folks how they get into security, and it's always, I just fell into it. It was not my intended trajectory, but I think those diverse backgrounds is what, you know, if everyone thinks the same, everyone goes to the same college and gets trained the same way, how do you bring, you know, your economic background and bring it in to like have a different view on things? And so I love that. I mean, I appreciate that there are colleges now that do train folks on cybersecurity, but you lose that diversity, you know, diversity of thought and experience. And I think that is key when we're looking at like, what are some new ways to protect things? I love hearing these kind of stories. Like, it actually wasn't my preferred path, but here I am.
And one thing that's probably worth noting is that the team I joined ran events. And so I had been running security conferences, and that was appealing to them, even though I didn't originally do any work in events, because the team itself did some event stuff. They were like, oh, this person has some experience in that. That's great. And so that was what I thought was hilarious, because that was what set me apart from other candidates, is that I'd been in that space. And since they did it, they were like, oh, well, we could use you for other things too.
I wonder what other industries are like that. I wonder if we were to, you know, do a podcast talking to people in, I don't know, manufacturing? I'm not sure. I just feel like, I wonder how unique this trend is of people finding themselves in cybersecurity without really intending to do that, or especially folks that have been in it for, you know, more than 5 years, perhaps less so now, because there are, you know, much more specialty courses and degrees available for cybersecurity, and people can come, you know, straight out of high school into college or into a technical college and find themselves straight in cybersecurity. I don't know. That's a rhetorical question. You shouldn't ask rhetorical questions on podcasts.
Yeah, but I was like, I don't know the answer to that. My hunch is it's unique that way. I mean, I think it's what's nice is, like, you know, people do different things in tech, and it doesn't really matter what path they go in tech, as long as they've done something in the space, whether it be, you know, development, or as I said, I did infrastructure. I know people have just done like frontline support and it moved. You know, as long as you have something, like, it's actually, I think, a nice sort of segment into security. You know, one of the things I've been struggling with personally is I help people, you know, make careers in this space, is figuring out what is entry level. And to this day, I don't have a good answer. And so I'm constantly trying to help people break in. And my big piece of advice right now is just, like, take a job in tech, because, like, that won't hurt you unless right. You're employed, right?
Yeah. I see a common entry-level title is usually analyst.
Yep.
But then you look and it's like, but you need 8 years of experience.
Yeah.
So, like, that doesn't make sense for folks that are, you know, especially those that are listening here. It's like, how do you get in? But that's a great piece of advice. Just take something in tech and then pivot from there. Because I think you can't go wrong if you're joining, you know, IT or help desk or the network team or any of those.
Right. And think about it. If you did help desk, you're used to helping people troubleshoot. And so a good segue then is to be like a SOC analyst. It's a different type of troubleshooting, right? But it's still a similar, like, you engaged with customers, you know, that customer service skill set that you need. You can easily talk to different types of folks, because, like, if you do frontline support, you talk to the full gamut of human beings. And so I think that's super, like, that's an easy pathway. I mean, the problem is there has to be the job. that's usually the main problem today.
Yeah, frontline support's a really interesting one. I've never worked in a call center, but when I was earlier in my time here at Microsoft, touched on a little bit in the Xbox business, and they have a relatively, a very, very, very mature infrastructure around how they sort of handle support calls. But what was fascinating and just blew my mind was that the first person that you often speak to is not really necessarily an expert. They probably become an expert, but they have scripts and they have these sort of complex sort of flowcharts that they follow that they're reading off a screen. And so, you know, yes, and that's in no way, shape, or form meant to diminish that role. But I just thought that was sort of fascinating that I sort of realized like, oh, wow, to be a frontline support person in a call center or in any other sort of scenario, you actually maybe depending on the area, and again, I'm generalizing just for the point here, you know, a lot of the times you're provided with the tools or the process that allows you to get up and running relatively quickly. And then obviously you develop more expertise. And if you come in with expertise, maybe you don't start at the front line. Maybe you sort of go up a tier or down a tier. The other thing I wanted to say, feel free to comment on that or correct me. But the other thing I was going to say is like, what about just get a job anywhere in a company that is in the technical space, and this day that's most of them. But on a previous podcast called Security Unlocked that I ran, you know, we spoke to a number of people in security at Microsoft who joined Microsoft in completely non-technical roles. Like some people came in as writers in the brand team, and some people came in as UX design. I guess that's technical, but people sort of, they joined Microsoft doing something that really wasn't technical or certainly not in the security domain, but through accepting opportunities and networking with people and sort of keeping their eye out for what was around and putting their hand up for sort of projects and V teams, got to get more experience and got to get more connections. And then they sort of found themselves in a technical capacity and then in security. And I just thought those stories are always fascinating and not always ones we think of.
Yeah, I think it's actually brilliant advice, right? If you're interested in it, just get in somehow and then raise your hand. Like I'm always telling people, just raise your hand. And I think like the more you raise your hand, the more opportunities you get. Like I think back to how I got involved in security conferences. I literally went to B-Sides Boston with a friend and it was a bit chaotic when I got there. And I asked someone, I was like, hey, do you need help with something? Because like I was getting for free, you know, like my logic was like, I could just help, right? Like, and they're like, yeah, could you do? And they started listing a bunch of things. I was like, sure, I can do that. And then I wrote to them and said, oh, I had a great time. It was so much fun, like engaging with all your sponsor. Because that's basically what I was doing, is helping sponsors get to the tables and get them set up and getting them water, right? Like weird tasks. But it's like, oh, that was so great. They're like, do you want to join the committee? And I was like, What does that mean? And they're like, it just means you have more responsibility. And I was like, sounds great. And so, I mean, I think just raising your hand and showing interest like goes a really long way. So yeah, I agree with you.
That's a great segue into what conferences are you working with now? I know you are pretty prominent with B-Sides Seattle. Any other conferences that you volunteer with?
Yeah. So it kind of changes year over year, depending on like what people need, which is kind of strange, right? Like you're just like, most people think you just continue doing the same things. I'm still involved with the Diana Initiative, and that's just a really fun conference since it's focused on getting folks from, you know, underappreciated backgrounds into cybersecurity. I just have a lot of affection for things like that. That one's very easy because I have a very defined role, and I love that because it just means I do the one thing and I'm done. I do B-Sides Seattle still. I used to do B-Sides Boston. That was a bit awkward. I ran B-Sides Boston from the West Coast for several years. And I kept being like, guys, someone needs to run this locally. I have done a lot of, I often will join initially to do CFP boards. So I love reading CFPs. I've done that for Day of Security, for AppSec Village. I did it for TEDx Seattle. And currently, I agree to do it for Forward CloudSec. So I tend to focus on community-driven conferences that have themes that I find interesting.
Community-driven, not like Black Hat or some of the like AppSec USA, the smaller, more homegrown
I like the homegrownness of them. And each one's really unique. What I always think is funny, because this year I went to four different B-sides, right? I was at B-side Seattle, I was at B-side San Francisco, B-sides Portland. Okay, so they're all mostly West Coast. Oh, wait, five. B-sides Las Vegas and B-side Chicago. And they all have very different feels and the audience is different and the energy is different. And they're all unique, right? And that's a lot of fun, I think. But in general, I like to give back to the community. Like, I feel like I'm where I am because people help me, especially like when I first got started. So that's where I focus my attention. There's a place for, you know, the RSAs and the Black Hats and the other really big ones. I can't think of all of them. And they're great. And I think people should do them. If I only have a finite amount of time, which is true because we don't have infinite amounts of time, I'm going to focus on the community-driven ones.
And Lee, connected to your focus on community-driven security conferences, by the way, I feel like you sort of underplayed your involvement in this space. You are one of the busiest. I feel like you have two jobs, right? You have your architect, intro architect at Microsoft, and then you have this other job, which is where you are running CFPs and volunteering, as well as presenting at security conferences. And I think if it's okay with me saying, you joked before we started recording that your hobby outside of cybersecurity is cybersecurity conferences.
It is.
Was there a pivotal moment? Did you go to a B-Sides Boston and just sort of did something happen? Or was there a session or a person or a thing that you sort of walked around and went like, wow, this is really different. This is really unique. And I want to be a part of this.
Yeah. And I can't remember the name of the speaker. It's just blanking. I can see her in my head. And she was giving a talk on digital forensics, which is nothing I have ever done, nor have I really even pursued it. But it was so different than anything I'd ever thought about. It's like infrastructure is it's very organized. It's very much like, you know, now you just build a server in the cloud. Back then you would like buy a server, rack a server, build a server, rinse and repeat, right? And I just remember being like, well, this is a whole new world I've never even thought about. And I should learn more. And that was kind of what started that journey, was just like every opportunity I got, I would go learn more.
Was it Alyssa Torres?
Yes. 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 I attended a talk that she did at B-Sides Boston a long time ago. And so I credit that talk with like really solidifying what I thought was an interest to like, oh, I really need to go and learn more.
Shout out to Alyssa Torres. We haven't had Alyssa on the podcast, but maybe we should reach out and see if we can see if we can spark some more. So B-Sides Boston sort of kicked it all off, and now you are the CFP lead for B-Sides Seattle. I was going to say, tell us about B-Sides. I might start. My understanding of B-Sides, I wandered into B-Sides Las Vegas completely by accident one year. I was there for, I think it was Black Hat and B-Sides overlap. I think I was there for Black Hat. And I was meeting up with someone and it turned out we were meeting up at B-Sides. And the way it was presented to me is like, well, B-Sides started as everyone that got rejected from Black Hat but thought like, well, this is silly. You know, there was no reason for this to be rejected because this content's amazing and let's just do our own thing over in another place area. But is that really how it started?
Yeah, that is really how it started. Like if you know the original players, which, you know, if you're active in the B-Sides community, you eventually meet a lot of the people who started the conference originally. And yeah, it started with, we wanted another venue. Well, they wanted another venue for people to give talks, right? That weren't, just places like Black Hat can only accept so many talks and they were still amazing talks. And sometimes, you know, maybe they're just a little bit too far off the beaten path. Maybe they're just a little bit too unique. There's like, one of the things I like about B-Sides is the content's very variable. Like, it's like everything, right? There's no pattern, right? It's just anything goes. And you see talks that, you know, they don't record depending on which track you're in because they're sort of like underground talks and they're talks that you can't actually record and, you know, you don't really want to talk about publicly, but they're interesting topics that people should talk about.
I feel B-Sides is very, what's the word? Like you feel very welcome at B-Sides. I've been to other conferences. I actually was able to speak at one of the B-Sides and I felt it just feels more comfortable. And I don't know how to explain that vibe, but it feels less. I've never had the pleasure of speaking at Black Hat or DEF CON, but that in itself, I've been to those conferences and it feels very different. It feels not as, I mean, probably because it's, you know, definitely like a bigger conference, more official, it's got, you know, but these sites just felt very welcoming and I appreciated that. I've only been to San Francisco. I haven't been to any of the other ones, but I assume that that vibe carries throughout any B-side you go to, even if they are slightly different from each other.
Oh, they're wildly different from each other. Like, that's the funny part. But yeah, that would be the one thing I think that links them all together is that it's super welcoming. And people, you know, are interested in hearing other people's ideas, even if they disagree. Nobody's going to sit there and heckle each other. Like, it's just a very much like free flow of ideas. And one of the things is I think really interesting is that they, if you do read, especially I think B-Sides Las Vegas does this the best, right? It's about like everybody is a participant, right? You're not just speaking at people. And so a lot of times if you are thinking about putting it in for a talk there, you're really thinking about how you engage the audience and make sure that that's explained in your CFP proposal, because that's kind of the expectation, right?
Yeah, which is a great segue into advice that you might have on how to submit for a conference. Like, you know, like you said, B-sides, you know, they want to know how you're going to participate with the audience. You know, as someone that has a strong writing background, plus multiple experiences of speaking at conferences, therefore you've submitted to many conferences. What are some tips, you know, advice that you can give folks, you know, that don't get accepted or, and are trying to? And Nick, yes?
Oh, I just wanted to add to that, and this is a bit cheeky, it's very much related to that question, but if B-Side started as all the talks that got rejected from Black Hat, and there's very much this sort of welcoming attitude and, you know, anything can really be presented at a B-Sides, how is that approach not antithetical to a call for papers where you're essentially asking people to pitch stuff that you either accept or reject? And I'm being a little cheeky intentionally. Like, how do you balance that ethos with the idea of a CFP? And I hopefully that will segue nicely into Wendy's question.
Well, I mean, you have to remember you can't accept everything that gets submitted. You don't have the time, right? And so the CFP is there to help you figure out what might most resonate with the audience, right? Like, that's usually, a lot of it is, do we think that this is a good talk and will this resonate with the audience? Is the simplest way to distill when you approach a CFP. I think one of the biggest things that I see, and to be clear, you know, I kind of got to cheat a little. I had probably read, by the time I started applying to conferences, I had probably read hundreds, if not thousands, of CFP submissions. Yeah, I'd done it for quite a long time. And part of it was just prior to joining Microsoft, I worked at companies where it was very hard to get approval to talk publicly. So I didn't really ever put together, you know, more professional CFPs. I only had to apply to things internally. And that's a very different experience than something that's run publicly, right? But when I read them, the biggest thing that I walk away with is that people don't provide enough information. They spend I joke about this. I don't know how long they spend, but it feels like they spent 5 to 10 minutes throwing something into a form and hitting submit. And the number one comment that I have made again and again, like I basically just like every time, well, this could be a really cool presentation, but I have no idea if it actually will be because I don't have enough information to gauge. And so when people are like, well, how do I make a better submission? Like, first of all, number one, follow the directions. Each CFP is different, right? And I found this out recently when I misread one and I realized it wasn't 300 words in the abstract, it was 300 characters. Caught it before we submitted, but I was like, I got to really cut this down. And so like reading what people require is super important because each one's different, right? Each one's unique. Each conference has a different feel, what they ask for. So like really read the directions and read like all the pages they give you. Don't skip that. I think most people skip that. I'll be really honest, just based on what I see. You know, make sure that there's enough information. Now, a 300-character abstract is hard, right? But I often recommend that if you don't know if it's going to land, have somebody else read it. And if you can, have somebody else read it who knows nothing about it. Because they can tell you whether they understand what you're going to talk about or not, and they feel like they want to show up or not, right? So we're constantly all, amongst my friends, we all exchange our CFPs all the time because we're, you know, you want to increase your chance of being accepted. I will say, like, if they give you optional fields, use all of them. I don't think you can actually provide, I mean, occasionally I see people who provide, in my opinion, too much. But for the most part, it's really hard to provide too much information. I think, you know, if you provide an outline, that's super helpful. If you provide audience takeaways, that's super helpful because it means you've really thought through what you're going to present. And those tend to stick out, right? Like someone who's thought through, like, here are the major sections that I'm going to talk through. Here's how long I think I'm going to spend in each section. Makes me think you've actually begun to think about the talk versus just putting in a quick description and you'll build it later.
So I took down 5 points. I took number one, read the instructions for what to submit or how to submit your as part of the CFP. Number two, have someone else read it before you submit. Number three, if there are optional fields, use them. For the most part, you know, you sort of can't, obviously you can provide too much information if you're just disgustingly verbose, but you know, those optional fields are often there for a reason. Provide an outline and audience takeaways if you can, and then and maybe even just an overview of the structure. Here are the major sections and here's how long I'll sort of take to present on each of those. Yeah. Did I get that right? Would they be your five?
Those are my five. And then like if you're doing a panel, right? What are the questions you're going to ask the panelists? Give the reviewer something to go on, right? Like, and one of the things we did with a panel recently that I thought was, I just remember thinking later, like, why have I never done this before? We actually listed, and most of these things are you know, anonymized, right? So you don't want to give out PII. But what we did is we say, like for me, right, principal security engineer at a major cloud provider, right? Or GRC manager in the aerospace industry. And so we listed the five folks participating in the panel through those like very like generic titles and generic company. Like we wouldn't say who they were or the actual company. But that way we can show like, hey, we've got this diverse panel with people from very different industries and different types of titles going to be in this. To be clear, that panel was on careers, so we wanted this diverse perspective. You know, obviously, if you're doing a panel on something like AppSec, you're going to like all the people are going to be AppSec. And then you're going to say like all the different companies in a genericized term where they work. But I actually thought that was super helpful. And so like going forward, if I was to continue to work on panels, that's something I would put in because I was like, oh, at least it gives them some sense of like who the panelists are because that's really hard often to tell in a CFP because it's all anonymized.
Now, is it always anonymized? Like, is there a scenario where you would say panelist one will be Lee Snyder from Microsoft, panelist two will be Wendy Zanoni from Microsoft? Like, when is it anonymized? When is it not? And is that the decision of the submitter or the decision of the conference?
It's almost always a decision of the conference. Most of them don't want to know. Like they want it to be blind. But sometimes they'll tell you up front it's not, right? I have a friend putting together a conference right now and it's a very much like a Sky Talks at DEF CON, which are not recorded. You know, it's a very much like underground kind of conference. And on that form, it's very clear that they want to know who the people are. So it just sort of depends on the conference, right? But you want to be really careful because what happens a lot is that people will also try to like leverage who they are, I would say, in the CFP without really doing a very good CFP. So it's like, oh, well, I'm the expert in X, so of course you'll accept my talk. And it's just a really bad submission, right? But they're trying to leverage who they are in industry to get in. And you do see that a lot.
I feel like that comes back to your point number one of sort of read the instructions for what and how to submit, because one would assume if the CFP is going to be voted on, I really want a better word or I want a better term for blind.
I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
I agree.
You know, where the names of the presenters or the names of the speakers are sort of withheld intentionally. that's, you know, and if you say like, hello, my name is Nick Fillingham from Microsoft, like, you know, you potentially have negated your submission simply by sort of announcing who you are. So that probably comes back to number one.
A lot of people who run CFPs will do a scrub before they let the board see it, right? And so a lot of times if I get things that don't meet the requirements or I think, you know, are a bit too and sometimes we're not as clear as we could be, right? Like, I think that's the other thing that a lot of CFPs could be better about. This is anonymized. These are the sections people will see. These are the sections that you submit, because if you get accepted, we need to have a bio for you, right? But I mean, I often go through and scrub things to make sure that people, you know, don't have things that will turn out to be very clear on who they are, right?
You'll scrub on behalf of the submitter.
I will, yes.
So the assumption perhaps you're making is the submitter has just inadvertently included their information, not realizing that it was not meant to be a part of the CFP. So you sort of give them the benefit of the doubt and you'll anonymize
always.
Them.
I will always give someone a benefit of the doubt. It takes a lot of, I'm sure confidence is the right word, but like it's hard to put yourself out there and it's hard to put your ideas out there. Like it takes courage, right? And what I don't want to have happen is you missed some little piece of the directions or you didn't realize it was done this way. And then you immediately get excluded. Well, no, because it could be a phenomenal talk. It's easy for me to scrub and make sure that you get the opportunity to be reviewed.
I have not submitted many applications, but the ones that I have, like when I first attempted it, I did not realize that you had... I thought you write one and you're done, right? So then I'm going to each website. I'm like, oh, this is totally different. Oh, this one's totally different. So that's where it comes into play of look at it, read it, see what their theme is. You know, your theme might need to be adjusted based on the theme of the conference. But with you, Lee, you get accepted very often. Do you ever have it where you submit, you know, let's say you're going for the shotgun approach. You're like, all right, I'll submit to all these. And then you're like, I got accepted to all of these.
Yeah, I made that mistake this year.
Do you speak at all of them? Do you like, okay, I made my bed, I'm lying in it kind of thing?
I'm one of those people, like, if you accept me, like, I'm showing up. Like, my mistake for just applying everywhere, it's on me. But, like, I feel like, you know, if it gets accepted, like, the committee saw something and they're going to want you to talk. So, like, this year I have to be... I actually have a list, like literally to the side on my desk of like things where we're starting to apply. So I don't end up doing that again.
What was your last round? What was the theme of your talk that you submitted?
So the two that I think I submitted the most last year, one was on, we have a vulnerability taxonomy in my organization and kind of talking about like why we built it, how we use it. Because I think a lot of times it's easy for security teams to skip foundational work. And so I'm a big fan of talking about foundational, less sexy work because we all need to do it. And kind of like, if I can give somebody a legs up on like how they could approach it to make it easier, that makes everybody's lives better. And the other big one was talking about career stuff, mostly focused on women in security. When I applied to B-Sides Portland, but I don't think they knew because, again, I'm pretty sure that's all anonymous. It was an all-female panel on purpose. And we got on stage and people were really kind of blown away by that. And talking about the paths for women in security was really important to me this year. And that only came about because I sat on a panel at B-Sides San Francisco about what it's like to be a staff plus security engineer. And as I'm on that panel and we're answering questions from the audience, I was realizing how different my experiences were from my male colleagues. And I was like, I want to keep talking about this, but I really want to talk about it with other women and have them share their experiences because it was so different. And it was sort of shockingly stark how different it was.
I want to ask about when submitting to a conference or even running a conference and running your own CFP or volunteering and helping out in a CFP in some capacity, the importance, but also the challenge of diversity. How, you know, and I guess there's two perspectives there. Like, you know, if you are a diverse candidate, how do you include your identity and your diversity in your CFP submission? Or perhaps do you, maybe is the question there, and if so, how? And then the second question is, how, as a CFP reviewer, owner, you know, lead, member of a board, how best to take into account the diversity of your submitters? So I guess it's you know, two parts of the question here. Like, if you have diversity in your identity and in your perspective and in your life experience and your genetics, et cetera, how do you bring that forward into your submission? And then on the other end, how do you ensure that obviously content is voted on by merit, but that diversity is a factor that is included, and it's included in a really sort of, you know, fair and balanced and healthy way?
Yeah. I think it depends on what you're talking about. Like, honestly, like, there's plenty of talks I put in and, you know, I just put them in. They're, you wouldn't know, right? You wouldn't know it's me and I'm a female in tech. Like, you would have no idea. And then it's like, if I want to talk about something very specific, I've been working on a talk with another woman about what it's like to be a staff plus engineer as a female, because there aren't a lot of like staff or principal security engineers. At least there's not a lot of them out there speaking about that experience and how they grew their careers to that level. So then obviously we self-identify, you know, we say that we're two women doing this talk. It really depends on like what you're willing to disclose, right? Like, and if you think that will help the submission or not, right? Like in our case, we really want to highlight for underappreciated groups paths, right? So we need to highlight that we come from those. But if I'm going to do a talk on a taxonomy, I'm probably not going to highlight that I'm a female second, because it's at that point, I'm not sure that necessarily brings anything. Now, to your point, when a CFP board is trying to make sure they have representation, that gets very difficult, right? Because as I said, a lot of us anonymize all this for a reason. So a lot of what we focus on is reach out to ensure that we just get a very good applicant pool. And that's what a lot of folks have moved towards. And so you're reaching out to all of the different groups that work in the cybersecurity industry to raise the profile of underrepresented and underappreciated folks, right? So like maybe you're reaching out to like WISIS, right? Like who's a big proponent, or you're reaching out to Blacks in Cyber because they've been doing a lot of phenomenal work. They even have a village, you know, at DEF CON. And so like I follow a lot of those groups, and I have to say, like, I'm so dismayed by like the collapse of Twitter, because that's made my job recruiting folks much harder. There's like obviously LinkedIn and Mastodon and Blue Sky, but nothing's really a replacement yet. So it's going to be an interesting year that way, I think, because a lot of us even last year were still using Twitter, you know, and I just feel like that's kind of just fell off the face of the cliff. And now we need to find something else. And so I don't know how that's going to go, right? And so like we've historically relied on reach out, because that way you have a really diverse pool coming in and a better likelihood of having people up there. I mean, I think also if you have folks on your like larger committee that come from one of those backgrounds, that tends to be, you know, signaling to other folks that this is an accepting, you know, kind of place and that they should apply. And so I really do, that is part of the reason I've done this for so long, is that I want to be very representative and show up as, you know, a woman on these committees that usually I'm the only one, because I want other women to apply and I want them to show up and I want them to learn. Right. And so I think like, we can have a debate of whether that is the right approach, but it's the approach I've decided to take because I care about it.
Lead by example. What advice do you have for folks that have submitted applications? They've been declined. What do you, you know, as someone that manages the CFPs for different conferences, do you give feedback like, hey, you know, not this year, here's what we suggest? Or do you just say not this year? And then if that's the case, what would you advise to folks, for folks that did get declined, what should they do? You know, what next step so they're not discouraged and not submitting again because of that?
Yeah, it's interesting, right? Because like, I remember the first time submitting and just being like, I have no idea how this will go. And then getting accepted to both things, thinking, oh no, I have to do two talks. I think, you know, first ask, right? If you get a reject, ask if there's any sort of feedback they can provide. A lot of times, you know, we're collecting feedback from CFP reviewers. And they may have to, you know, tone it down or change the language or like anonymize it, but they may be able to provide feedback if asked. But if you don't ask, you'll never get it, right? Some conferences, and like Day of Security is actually very good at this. They actually provide feedback to everyone, whether you get accepted or rejected or waitlisted. You know, they actually provide feedback in those emails, which I think is really impressive. And I know how much work that must be for that team. So try to find a conference that says they'll do feedback. There's also conferences that will help you. So for example, at the Diana Initiative, if you put in round one and you don't get accepted, they will provide you with a mentor who will help you improve your CFP submission, who will work with you one-on-one and basically be like, well, here are the things I would change, right? And here's why I would change it. And like a lot of times those folks will also, because I've done that mentoring, I will be like, this conference, you know, doesn't have a high accept rate because they get so many submissions. Here are some other ones that you would have a better chance, probably just due to the amount of submissions, right? Like your local B-sides, normally, unless you're like San Francisco or Las Vegas, is not going to have like this huge like outpouring. Like some of the larger ones, obviously, they're much more competitive, right? And so some of it's just luck of the draw, unfortunately. So I tell people always like, hey, this is a really hard conference. An example is WISIS. I think the accept rate is 5%. That's really hard, right? Let's be clear. You could put in an amazing submission and you would probably still get rejected because that's a numbers game, right? And so part of it is looking to see if they publish statistics on, you know, how often they accept. But I would also say like smaller conferences, put in, like get involved in the different meetups and see if you can do the talk there and get feedback, and that would help you improve. I mean, there's so many avenues to get out and do your talk. Like worst case, just record it, right? And put it on the internet. And so it like can get people to start paying attention. And then you have that as a reference.
I love that idea. As someone that has not been accepted to many conferences, though I've submitted, it is inspiring me now to try again.
Yeah, I do think like having somebody else review it can go a really long way. Like I did have a friend review something for a really competitive conference because I was like, I don't think we have a, like, I'll be really honest. I was like, there's no way we're getting accepted. But he still like went through the process of having somebody else review it to make it as strong as possible. So there's so many people out there that they're willing to review things. So you just have to ask.
Yeah, I love it. So I think we are coming up on timely, but I'm going to recap your I think it's six, but there may be seventh. Let's six. So it's read the instructions so that you know exactly what you need to submit as part of the CFP, which may include being anonymous. It may include actually not being anonymous. It may also have a character limit or even a letter limit, which would be, you know, sorry, a word limit or a character limit. Definitely have someone else read it. And don't be afraid to ask for help or ask for people to have eyes on it. If there are optional fields, use them because they're probably there for a reason. Provide an outline and what the audience takeaways are, what you think the audience is going to get or what you're going to present to them in your session. Maybe break it down by sections and how much time you'll spend on each. And then if you're doing something like a panel, include the actual panel questions or some of those panel questions. So you can, you know, give the reviewers an idea of, first of all, what the panel will be, but also, I assume, prove that you've thought about this. It's not just a catchy title. You just didn't come up with a pun in the middle of the night and you thought, you know what? Let's submit the pun, see if it gets approved, and then we'll back into it. Anything you want to add to that? I'm sure there's more tips and tricks, but is that a good summary?
The other thing is, like, if they offer, you know, any sort of mentoring or for CFPs, take advantage of it.
Take it. That's a great idea. That's a great one. All right. So that's our seventh, is if they offer mentoring, absolutely take it. Before we let you go, where are you presenting? What's coming up for you? Can you tell us where you're going to be presenting next, or is some of that stuff a little secret?
None of the accepts are out yet. So I won't know for a while still. Yeah.
I see. Okay.
So I have been submitting, but I won't know for a bit.
Got it. And then the conferences that you are helping organize, one of which is B-Sides Seattle.
Yep.
I believe the call for papers is actually open now.
The call for papers is open and open through early January.
Through early January. And a quick plug for what you're looking for. Is there a theme this year or is this?
Oh, we do have a theme. I'm going to totally botch it. It's a, I know gratitude is in there. It takes a village.
Oh, I have your website in front of me.
Oh,
can
good.
Can I tell you? It says yes. 2024 theme is gratitude and growth, colon, it takes a village.
Yes. So that's a very generic theme, let's be clear. But, you know, if anything around, you know, giving back or how you've grown or, you know, working with others to get to a place, like all those and plus more would be awesome. And it really is a true B-side, so... You know, anything related to security, privacy is fair game in my book. So please apply.
My wheels are spinning right now. So I'm sure there are plenty of folks that are listening and are feeling inspired. So thank you for this. This is, it makes it more, it feels more tangible and inclusive, like to have you on the show and talk about how to apply and you're going to get rejected and it's fine. Just keep doing it. I mean, it doesn't mean you're not amazing at what you do. It just means that a lot of amazing people did apply and there's only room for so many, but it's not a personal thing. And, or maybe you just need to improve your writing skills a little bit. I know that that's not my strong point. So
I think it just, you know, I was on a call yesterday explaining like my wheels are turning about like, what do I want to talk about this year beyond the couple that have been percolating for a while? And I was saying, on this call that like, I think it's really hard because you're like, am I really an expert in this? Am I really the person who should be talking on this? And then if you're me and you're watching what's happening, you're realizing that there's plenty of people who are just willing to do it. And so this is my recommendation. Just try it. Like, don't talk yourself out of it before you even do it. And so I'm trying to like embrace that myself, because I even struggle with that as someone who does do a lot of talks, does get accepted. I still struggle with that, like this whole concept of imposter syndrome. I couldn't possibly know what I'm talking about. Just try. Like, I implore everybody who's listening, just try it out. Like, give it a shot. Like, it takes so much courage to do it, and you should be proud of doing, like, standing up and just showing up and trying, right? And if you don't get accepted, just ask for that feedback so you can be better next time.
I love it. Well, thank you, Lee. Thank you for being on the show.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. This was a lot of fun.
It is. And for anyone that heads out to B-Side Seattle and you see Lee.
Yeah, please say hi.
Say hello. Thank you very much. And we look forward to having you on again in the future.
Sounds great.
Thank you, everyone. Have a good day. Thank you for joining us for the Blue Hat Podcast.
If you have feedback, topic requests, or questions about this episode,
please email us at bluehat@microsoft.com or message us on Twitter at @MSFTBlueHat.
Be sure to subscribe for more conversations and insights from security researchers and responders across the industry
by visiting bluehatpodcast.com or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.